This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochran, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Monday, March 25th. The federal government says Ontario is not building enough affordable homes fast enough, and for that, the province could lose out on millions in federal cash. Just ahead, Federal Housing Minister Sean Fraser is here. Meanwhile, Premier Doug Ford is promising a spending plan this week that tackles affordability. This hour, what we've learned about tomorrow's provincial budget. Plus, Israel calls off a visit to Washington after the United Nations Security Council demands a ceasefire in Gaza for the first time. What that turn of events could mean for Israel's war against Hamas. We begin with the fight over housing between Ottawa and Ontario. The federal government is threatening to withhold more than $350 million in federal funding, arguing the province is lagging desperately behind others when it comes to getting affordable homes built. The issue is also causing clashes at Queen's Park. Opposition parties are disappointed that Premier Doug Ford has ruled out automatic approvals for fourplexes.
The Premier is ruling out affordable housing options in the middle of a housing crisis. People need a place to live, and this government's solution is to go to war against fourplexes. It makes no sense.
I believe in letting municipalities decide. Just imagine if your neighbor sold their house, they tore it down, and put a six-story tower beside you. No, that's not going to fly. I've been in politics long enough.
Sean Fraser is the federal housing minister, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
In the letter I had that you sent to Ontario's Paul Calandra, you gave him until end of day Friday to submit a new housing plan, or they could lose this federal money. It's end of business day Monday. Where are things with Ontario?
So first, let me just start out by saying, if we're going to solve the housing crisis, not just play around the margins, but solve it, we need all of us working together. I had an exchange of letters with Minister Calandra, urging them to meet the obligations that they've agreed to as part of the bilateral agreement we signed with the province of Ontario. They did respond with a revised action plan. Initially, they had only been able to point to about 6% of the total number of units, affordable units, they'd agreed to have constructed under the fund. The revised plan does indicate that they've reached about one-third of the target, but it doesn't yet point to concrete steps that will help them get there. Having just received the plan, we are now going to conduct an assessment before we take a final decision on what will happen with the $357 million at stake. But my goal is to use it to maximize the number of affordable housing units we can build in Ontario, because Ontario's housing crisis in many ways is a major contributor to Canada's national housing crisis.
Okay, so Ontario has responded to your concerns on their affordable housing plan. I mean, at first blush, does it look like they've gone all the way that you wanted them to go, or is it not manifestly clear when you first look at what they've submitted to your department?
So what it's still missing today is a clear path to actually help build the nearly 20,000 affordable housing units that they have agreed to build under the initial agreement. Keep in mind, this is after a one-year extension. We do want to see if we can get to a place where the money will be used to build affordable housing. But to date, we have not actually seen the progress that we would like to see that would demonstrate Ontario is actually meeting the obligations that it agreed to when it signed the deal in the first instance.
So do they get a third of the way there, halfway there? Is it possible to benchmark it for us?
So if you include the federally funded projects that the province has made a contribution to, the number of units that they've been able to point to is a little bit less than one-third of the total, which obviously is an improvement over the 6% that we were dealing with previously. But what it fails to demonstrate so far is that they're going to find a way to actually construct the balance of the number of affordable housing units under the term of the agreement, which is obviously concerning. But this is something we need to conduct a further assessment on to identify whether it's possible for the province to achieve the target they've agreed to. And once we make that final determination, we'll have a decision, hopefully in a short period of time, as to what will happen with that $357 million.
Okay, so you say one-third. So they've got a plan for about 6,000 or 7,000 of the 20,000. It's that 13,000, 14,000, whatever that remainder is that you haven't seen a plan for. I'm understanding the math correctly.
Look, yeah, rough ballpark. That's the balance we're looking for a plan for, yes.
Okay, because the response from Paul Calandra, the Ontario Housing Minister, is that if you withhold this money, you're just hurting vulnerable people, that even if they don't get all the way there, they get part of the way there, and that makes things better. So this $350-plus million, what happens to that if you end up taking it away from Ontario?
Well, look, first of all, I've got to ask myself, what kind of a housing minister would I be if I didn't insist that the partners that receive federal funding in exchange for meeting home building obligations, if I simply said that's okay, we're going to give you the money anyway and not insist on performance of the very things you said you would do. That said, my goal is not to pull money away from affordable housing in Ontario. Quite the contrary. We want to do whatever we can to put the money towards affordable housing in Ontario. And I just want to determine whether the province of Ontario is going to be a good partner by actually meeting the obligations that they said that they would meet when we signed the agreement. It's not responsible for a government to make an agreement and simply allow partners not to deliver when, in fact, it's the same group of people, Canadians, that are depending on our partnership, our collaboration, and the different levels of government working together to solve the housing crisis. So we will find a way to support additional affordable housing construction in Ontario. The question for me is whether Ontario is going to be the partner that delivers on a portion of that a target that we're working towards as a result of the money that we're transferring to them.
What's your sense of where Ontario is as a partner on housing, not just on the affordable housing issue, which this is about, but on housing writ large, when you've heard the Premier say multiple times now that fourplexes are off the table as baseline available everywhere in Ontario because he doesn't think municipalities can get behind it necessarily or that citizens can get behind it necessarily. How does Ontario meet its housing needs, given a stance like that from the Premier?
So let's use that example. And you've got to ask yourself, when you buy a piece of land, what are you actually entitled to? Because most people think they can do what they want on their own land. But there are governments over the course of decades who've adopted policies that literally make it illegal to build a home that provides a roof over the head for more than one family in the same building in most neighborhoods in Canada. My view is that in a housing crisis, it's not reasonable for any level of government to say to a private landowner that they're not allowed to build homes for more neighbors when we need more homes to accommodate the people who live in communities now. We need to change our mindset and legalize housing. We need to make it legal for somebody to build a fourplex. I visited communities that have very nice homes that provide a roof over the head of multiple families. I was in Kelowna during our Housing Accelerator Fund, where one of the residents let me walk through his home. It was beautiful. It was on a park. It met the character of the existing neighborhood. It was a few blocks from school where he walked his kids every day. There's nothing untoward about allowing four families to live in a single building. If we actually change the rules at a city level, which was a big part of the Housing Accelerator Fund, we can make it much easier, much faster, and much cheaper. You can't ask yourself, look, do I want that kind of change? You have to ask yourself, am I willing to live with the alternative, which is going to have a generation of young people priced out of the market, potentially in perpetuity, both to rent and to buy. We need to make it easier to build homes. We need to make it faster to build homes. We need to make it cheaper to build homes so everyone has an affordable place to live.
Premier Ford keeps comparing fourplexes to towers. He uses towers and building four-story towers next to existing homes as part of his reason against this. I mean, is a fourplex necessarily a tower, in your view, as federal housing minister?
There are fourplexes in my community that have one story. There are fourplexes that I visited that have two-story. In fact, most of them are one- and two-story buildings that I've seen with my own eyes. I think that's an attempt to mischaracterize the nature of the kinds of homes that we're talking about in order to turn the public against this opportunity to build more homes. These are reasonable homes for people at different stages in their lives, both to rent and to buy. They can put a downward pressure on the price of the price of a place to live. If we're not doing everything we can to reduce the cost of living for people during an affordability crisis and to build as many homes as we can during a housing crisis, then we're not playing our cards the right way. We need to do everything we can to solve the housing crisis. It's going to put a roof over people's head and save families money, and I think that's a good idea.
So we have Premier Ford, though, saying that his government won't move on fourplexes as a standard right in Ontario. They're going to leave that up to municipalities. There's the issue with Minister Calandra you're having over affordable housing, and we've also seen cities such as Windsor, Ontario, which have rejected the conditions in the Housing Accelerator Plan and just lost out on the money because they don't want to build houses in a way that complies with what you're looking for as a federal government. So what concerns do you have on your ability to achieve your housing goals and your housing objectives in Canada's largest province, which if it's not facing the biggest housing challenge, it's in the top two in provinces? How worried are you right now with these sorts of obstacles and pushback coming?
Well, look, those are not the only obstacles. I can also point to the major transit station areas, because the city of Toronto actually made an agreement with us to dramatically increase density in and around transit stations, but needs approval from the provincial government. Now, they're saying a lot of the right things. I do want to see action in this regard. But to your question on what my concerns are about certain communities or the provincial government not addressing this density issue, keep in mind the province could, with the stroke of a pen, change the rules and allow more density province-wide. Because that hasn't been happening, we move forward with the Housing Accelerator Fund to incentivize cities to make those kinds of changes. The good news in all of this is there's not a shortage of cities that have the level of ambition that we want to see. When we put money on the table, we had a program that was oversubscribed by several 100%. We had 540 applications and finished the fund of $4 billion with 179 agreements. There are hundreds of additional cities who want to do more that weren't in this first round of funding through the Housing Accelerator Fund. What we see is a changing attitude at a local level in every part of this country, because people are coming to understand that if they want to obtain the benefits from population growth, from economic growth, they got to make room for a place for people to live.
So just as a final point, Minister, if the interest is so great and the enthusiasm so high at the municipal level, why do you think Doug Ford is so adamant and in saying that municipalities don't necessarily support this idea?
Look, change can be difficult when you're trying to manage the politics of a given issue. But if you actually divorce yourself for the moment from what might be easy to sell in different kinds of neighborhoods and ask yourself what is the right thing to do, you're going to quickly come to the conclusion that in a housing crisis, you should build more houses. This is one of the things that we can do that we know has proven successful in different places in the world to make it easier and faster to build more homes. That's something that we want to achieve as a federal government, and we hope that the government of Ontario will be a partner in this regard.
Federal Housing Minister Sean Fraser, thanks for your time today.
A pleasure, as always.
Well, it's a first since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. The UN Security Council has voted to demand an immediate ceasefire.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254 please raise their hand?
The resolution was put forward by the 10 elected members of the council. It calls for a ceasefire during the rest of Ramadan and for Hamas to free the hostages taken on October 7th. 14 nations voted in favor of the resolution. The United States, Israel's staunchest ally at the council, abstained from the vote. And that abstention angered Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He says the resolution did not make a ceasefire contingent on the release of Israeli hostages by Hamas. Netanyahu has now canceled a planned visit of a senior Israeli delegation to Washington this week. Rhonda Sleem is a senior fellow and director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues program at the Middle East Institute. John Allen previously served as Canadian ambassador to Israel. He's now a senior fellow at the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. It's good to see you both again. Thanks for taking the time today.
Good to be with you.
Rhonda, let's start with your reaction to this vote at the UN Security Council. It's been competing vetoes back and forth from the various sides of this. What do you make of the ceasefire demand and the U.S. decision not to block at this time and to abstain?
Well, it's better late than never, and it's something is better than nothing, you know. But will it change the trajectory of the conflict? Will it stop Israel from continuing its military offensive? Already during her speech, after the adoption of this resolution, the USUN ambassador said it's non-binding, when we know that all United Nations Security Council resolutions are legally binding on all UN member states. And we had also the director of communication at the White House repeating the same sentence. It's non-binding. It's like it's on one hand, it's good that they have abstained. On another, they are saying, well, it's not important. That's the kind of messaging they are sending.
So on that, Benjamin Netanyahu, John, seems to think it's important because he was pretty angry reacting to the U.S. decision not to veto. And he's decided to cancel planned talks with Israeli and American officials this week in Washington. So what do you make of that development and Netanyahu's reaction?
Well, it's typical Bibi Netanyahu these days. Everything he has done vis-a-vis the Biden administration has been negative. No two-state solution. We're going into Rafah. We're not allowing humanitarian aid, et cetera, et cetera. And this is particularly difficult because the U.S. administration has been saying, you know, you should not be going into Rafah unless you have a plan. And presumably the Israelis were coming to Washington to explain what their plan was. And now Bibi's canceled it in a funk.
But yet, John, on that point, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, he was in Washington today. He was meeting with Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, and they seem pretty clear they're going to go in to Rafah based on what he said. He released a statement saying we will operate against Hamas everywhere, including in places where we have not yet been. That's really just Rafah, isn't it? Isn't that how you take it?
Well, they don't have sufficient troops in Gaza right now to start that operation or to finish it. I hope that they are heeding U.S. warnings that when they do it, they're going to do it, A, in a targeted way, and B, they're going to try and move the 1.3 million Gazans that are there. Because if they don't do either of those, and they do a major operation, then a lot of people are going to get killed, and Israel is going to come under even more fire than they are now. It will be very, very difficult. I understand where Israel's coming from in the sense that they think they've now got Hamas located, and they want to get the leaders that they've spent 5 months trying to get. But if it comes at the price of a massacre, that's, you know, obviously completely and totally unacceptable.
So, Rhonda, how do you interpret those comments from Defense Minister Gallant? I know everything Israeli officials we've had on the show point to is that they want to break this cycle of violence by completely breaking Hamas leadership. Do you take this as an inevitability they go into Rafah despite all of the urging and things like this vote today?
I think the statement by Vice President Kamala Harris yesterday when asked about the Rafah operation, especially when she said, I looked at the maps, I don't see where this 1.4 million people can be taken. Mm-hmm. So for me, this was as clear a statement that even if Israel were to come with a plan, that the U.S. does not believe there is a plan that involves attacking Rafah. At least that's what I surmised from her statement. There is not a plan, at least now on the table, that can, you know, that will involve a ground offensive, an Israeli ground offensive on Rafah, similar to what we have seen in other places of Gaza, like, you know, Khan Yunis and others. And at the same time, that will avert a humanitarian disaster. Because as she said, there's no other place to take them, you know, 1.4 million people. And so I think this is where the two countries are stuck. I think they share the objective. There is a growing gap between the U.S. and Israel. But on the objective of defeating Hamas, I think that objective in absolute terms is shared. The problem is, what are those success criteria each party is using in determining whether that objective has been achieved or not? I don't think there is convergence on that yet. Mm. And then, of course, the humanitarian situation. There is a very wide gap on the humanitarian situation and what Israel is doing in blocking UNRWA. And by the way, thank you, Canada, for resuming funding to UNRWA. I hope the U.S. will follow suit.
Well, Rhonda, I wonder if I can ask you a question. We know negotiations on ceasefire and hostage exchange continue in the background of the conflict with really no success since the original exchange weeks and months ago. We've had a bulletin move on the wires saying that Hamas says it has in 4 mediators it will stick to the original position for comprehensive ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, return of the displaced, and a real exchange of prisoners. That's a non-starter for Israel. Israel's position is a non-starter for Hamas. This seems utterly intractable at this point.
It is. I mean, there is definitely not an agreement, but also it's not the end of the negotiations. I still am, you know, I still of the opinion that both sides will want to achieve an agreement, but each side is trying to get the best deal they can. There is a realization among Hamas and that Israel is in a tough position internationally, is in a tough position domestically, the division inside Israel. And on the other hand, I think there is disagreement among the different wings of Hamas about what they should pursue next. And again, what is the success of victory mm-hmm. for them? For them, the threshold is much lower. They just have to survive. Whereas for Israel, it has to achieve some kind of victory, no matter how it, I don't know how it's going to define it. But there is definitely also disagreement among the different wings of Hamas, internal, the external, the internal different groups about what needs to be done. This is a matter of not only political survival for Hamas, it's a matter of physical survival. Yeah. And so I think they are, you know, they are going to stick by, I'm not saying it's a good position or it's a good place where we are today, given what the Palestinians and, you know, the Israelis also are going through, but mostly the Palestinians are going through. But we are where we are. And I think, it's tough, but the negotiation is not over.
No, the negotiations aren't over, John. But if that is the position Hamas is taking, and that is clearly not something a Benjamin Netanyahu-led government is ever going to agree to, how then, after what happened on October 7th and this position being held now, how then can the U.S. and others convince the Israelis not to go into Rafah? And why would they not go into Rafah if this is the posture that Hamas is going to stay with?
Well, if Hamas, there was a feeling that Hamas was finally moving away from their demand for a permanent ceasefire. That, to me, is the key right now, because the numbers, I think, can be agreed on, 800 versus 40 and staged, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And Israeli forces can withdraw from certain areas. The key is whether Hamas is going to continue to demand that this is a permanent ceasefire. That's not going to happen. The view of the international community is that if there is a temporary ceasefire, it might lead, as the resolution calls for, it might lead to a more permanent ceasefire. That's what we need. We need to get a ceasefire on the ground. We need hostages exchanged. And then we need the negotiations to continue and hopefully move towards a more permanent ceasefire and perhaps having the Hamas leadership leave the area if they're not killed beforehand. Hamas really does have to back away from that. And I was of the view that that might have been happening. And I'm just wondering whether this resolution now has stiffened their demands yet again, as the Americans said it might do. And we're going to have to hope, as Rhonda said, that the negotiations are not over and that there'll be more flexibility on both sides.
Well, John, just on that point, maybe Hamas feels emboldened and they've stiffened their demands, as you say, because of it. But I've also seen Aaron David Miller say that Netanyahu's reaction, essentially, he's digging in, playing to the political base that is keeping him in power throughout this, and it's going to make it that much harder on the Israeli side. Aaron David Miller is a very smart guy. Do you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, well, Bibi has been digging in all along, but he has sent his head of Mossad and other negotiators and did give them some increased flexibility. I think he's under continuing pressure to get those hostages released and wants them released as he wants to get the Hamas leaders. So, yes, they're both playing tough to the crowd and to the public, but I'm hopeful that there's some serious negotiations going on behind the scenes.
Rhonda, your final thoughts on that, where you think this may leave the ability to have talks that move forward, if Hamas, at least publicly, looks maybe a bit emboldened by this, and if this does force a sort of an entrenchment by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government?
Yes, I think both sides are going to, dig in. And as we have seen Hamas do, the Prime Minister of Israel do as well. But again, they need to keep talking while they are fighting and while this war continues. There is no other way. I don't think, Netanyahu can release hostages by military means. And I don't think Hamas will be able to, keep demanding of its people and of its constituents to take more of the killing, especially with Rafah, with the offensive looming in Rafah. So both sides, they need, in a way, in a weird way, they need the other to agree to to help them achieve their objectives, mostly on a domestic level. And so I think, you know, the fighting will continue, unfortunately, yes. The killing will continue, unfortunately, yes. But I think the negotiations will continue.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Rhonda Sleem, John Allen, thank you so much. We always appreciate when you join us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, David.
The Doug Ford government will deliver the 2024 Ontario budget tomorrow, and it will include increased choice for Ontario drivers to lower their insurance premiums. Our Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Mike Crawley, broke that news, and Ontario's finance minister responded to a degree.
We're always working on making things more convenient and providing more choice for auto drivers, people, drivers. But you won't be surprised. I'm not going to reveal what's in tomorrow's budget.
Well, what else should we expect to hear from the Ford government tomorrow? The Power Panel is back on that. Rob Russo, Jamie Ellerton, Brad Levine, and Vandana Cotter. Jamie, there is this news of something to help people with the price of insurance. We've also seen reports that the cut they made to the gas tax that was supposed to expire in June is going to be extended until the end of the year. These are things that cost. These are things that probably don't get them closer to that balanced budget they promised a while back that they've now had to push off. Well, what do you make of where Ontario appears to be heading with this?
Yeah, I suspect you're going to see kind of a mix of two things from the Ford government's budget tomorrow. One is going to be a continued investment of infrastructure and following through on the get it done slogan that they ran on and showing progress on transit and transportation projects that they've announced and spent a lot of political capital on to advance. And the other is on affordability, which is why I think you saw the pre-positioning with the gas tax announcement today. And on the insurance one, David, if it kind of you read the tea leaves on this, this might not actually cost the Treasury any money. And instead, it's just allowing you to opt out of certain clauses of your insurance premiums to ultimately lower your bill and, of course, also lessen your coverage. And anyone who's ever shopped for insurance knows it's kind of like buying tickets for Ticketmaster. There's so many add-ons and fees that you don't really know what you got at the end of the process. And in this era of increased affordability challenges, you can't turn around with some other company, some other fee, someone else reaching into your pocket. And taking more out of it. And so I think the Ford government's trying to find a way to lessen that impact and do so creatively so that they can continue to get the Ontario budget on a path back to balance.
No, you're right. I mean, there are regulatory changes you can make at the provincial level that affect that. But, you know, Vandana, I wonder, they also were hearing some indication they're going to try to crack down on auto theft. We just had that big summit here in Ottawa because Ontario's got a massive problem with this. But I wonder about the gas tax break. Doing this, even though inflation's starting to bend down, fuel prices are always kind of volatile. Is it just because of the political imperative on affordability, even though there are some warnings that this is the sort of thing that the provincial level that maybe is having that upward pressure on inflation?
I think what they're trying to do with both the gas tax as well as all insurance show is how they're trying to save Ontarians money. I think this is a political piece that they need to have. I think Doug Ford, you know, is nervous. I think Bonnie Crombie makes him nervous. I think he wants to have a good showing on these by-elections. I think he really wants to show that, you know, I'm here for the people. This affects your pocketbook issues, and I'm going to address them. And I don't think that balancing the budget is like a key priority in that scenario. I think right now people are looking at how they can relieve some of the pressure they're feeling on expenses. So whether it's good policy or not, I'm not sure, but I know that's going to help a lot of Ontarians. And when they hear about this, they'll feel pretty good about it.
So, Brad, we've got the extension of the gas tax holiday here in Ontario at a time when the federal carbon price is set to increase on April 1. Is there some of that intersectional politics at play here to try to like buttress against criticism over cost of living by sort of countering some of the increase from the federal policy, even though the rebate goes up with it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure Pierre Poilievre does not like what either Ford or Wabkinew in Manitoba are doing with their lowering their gas. You know, I found it fascinating. The extension is not, you know, a surprise, but this will not be the only extension here. You don't have something, I think, on December 31st expire, and then all of a sudden, you know, January 1, the tax will go up. I bet you, David, there will be another announcement sometime late in the fall, early December, that they'll extend the gas holiday gas tax holiday yet again. Affordability is a huge issue. We've talked about the housing crisis. That is obviously a very major affordability challenge. But, you know, people are still struggling. We've got, you know, day-to-day costs are going up, particularly things like food, you know, and other costs are going up. So if Ford can point to two things that millions of Ontarians do, that is insure their cars and obviously fill it up full of fuel, if he can save people money on those two things, you know, it's that How do you see the citizenry of Ontario? You know, he sees them as drivers first and foremost, because it's something people do almost every day outside of a small group of people that live in the major centers. So they do that. So that's very smart marketing, and it's, you know, whether or not, you know, the gas is, you know, $1.50 a liter or whatever it is, at least he's out there, and he's making an attempt to show Ontarians that he's on their side. We've also got things like mortgages coming up for a renewal. We've got, obviously, hopefully, relief from interest rates later in the summer here. So, you know, the timing could all be quite good for a good summer for consumers, at least from Doug Ford's perspective, in terms of helping people with their wallets.
Rob, such cynicism from Brad there that this pause on the gas tax might be reannounced again and extended down the road. Because it's interesting, because Alberta just undid theirs, right? And they're going to see the tax come back on. And I guess it speaks to the challenges of the demand to pause carbon pricing, because you then get stuck in a situation where it's politically too difficult to unpause it. What do you think is going to happen with Ontario?
I think the ghost of John Crosby has haunted conservative government since 1979, when he was going to raise the gasoline by 18 cents a gallon, which is about 4 or 5 cents a liter. Mm-hmm. And that brought down the conservative government of Joe Clark. Look, I was driving over the weekend, and I knew prices were going to go up today. So I went across the river in Quebec, where in an extraordinary event, they were actually cheaper there by about 10 or 11 cents yesterday than they were in Ottawa. So I filled up there. That tells you, though, that in one day, the price of gasoline can fluctuate 10 or 11 cents. Do people actually notice when it goes up and down that much? No. But would they notice if a conservative government raised it? Yes, they would. Hmm. The area between Niagara Falls and Peterborough is where you have the highest insurance rates in the country, in many instances, because of the commute. People commute. Huge commute. Our insurance has gone from about $15.55 a year to $17.44, about $200 up.
That's real
in
money.
2 years.
Yep.
Yeah, and maybe if he built some fourplexes, people wouldn't drive as much, and they wouldn't pay as much in insurance.
Yeah, Jamie, I don't know if we're going to see a fourplex fund in the budget tomorrow, but this comes a couple of weeks from now. We're going to see the federal budget. I just wonder, do you anticipate like a massive overlap in the priorities and the issues here? Because, going back to the conversation we had earlier in the show, $353 million in federal money that is due to expire at the end of this month because of the lack of sort of like commitment on some levels, from the Ford government here, at least, according to the federal government. How do you think this may set the stage for what we're going to see in Ottawa next month?
When it comes to the Ford government's relationship with the Trudeau government, they kind of go back and forth of like jostling for their own political purposes and drawing specific frames. Like the carbon tax frames is a great example. Not only do they get to run against the carbon tax, which is kind of riding on the coattails of what Pierre Poilievre has been able to do in terms of popularizing the issue, but the Ford government and the PC party has spent the first 3.5 months of Bonnie Crombie's tenure as Liberal leader trying to say she's a carbon tax liberal. And so it'll give them more and more opportunity to talk about those frames. So I think ultimately, if the feds are dangling real money, Doug Ford has shown time and time again, he has real trouble resisting any of that money and takes it with all the conditions attached. So I have no doubt that after this posturing about affordability, gas tax, carbon tax, and the pure politics of it all, that if they want the money for housing, they'll find a way to get it and come to some agreement in the dying days of the spring session.
Of course, Rhonda, you only pay the carbon tax in Ontario because the Ford government scrapped the cap and trade agreement that was there. Yep. Otherwise, it'd be the same system as they have in Quebec.
But, right, because that was taking Ontario's money and sending it to California so they could lower their emissions.
I'm just saying they're free to come up with their own plan. Any provincial government is free to come up with their own plan. But, they haven't. But I wonder, does it create any upward pressure if they do things in this government at the Ontario level for the federal government? I'm sure the federal budget is pretty much locked down with about 16, 17 days to go. But if Ontario goes hard on affordability while the federal government is trying to find a way to rein in spending, right, to keep deficits at around 1% of GDP, does it have any impact on the federal thinking and national politics as it plays out in Ontario?
I don't really think it's going to, David.
Oh,
sorry.
What's that?
I'm sure you're talking to.
Sorry, Jamie, I was asking Vandana, but you got a quick thought? Go right ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I really don't think it is. I think they're talking to two very different audiences and two kind of ongoing media markets. And although, yes, the federal-provincial relations stuff crosses, really they're talking into their respective camps.
Okay, sorry, Vandana, go ahead. That was I set that up very confusingly. That was my fault. You,
that's
sure,
okay.
You go.
I agree with Jamie, actually. I don't think that'll weigh on the province, on the Feds very much. I think they're really focused on affordability, but they're going to show where you're going to invest. They want to show that you don't want an austere budget. If you cut everything, you know, you look at things like what Pierre Poilievre's doing on cutting foreign aid, and in a time where you kind of need foreign aid. So I think they're going to try and show that, you know, this is what we're going to choose what to invest in, and it's investing in Canadians where they need it the most. But they'll be smart about it and figure out ways of where we do cut spending. Where is there extra things that, like within the government, that you can rein in a bit more without affecting Canadians directly?
Right. So, Brad, I know from my conversations with people in the Ontario government, the focus is really about labor force development, right? That they think there's a lot of economic opportunity, that the demographic challenges sort of limit their ability to capitalize on it. They want to get more people trained up to work in the trades in particular and invest in some of the big things like we saw with the nuclear refurbishment not that long ago. I mean, where do you think they go economically here beyond just the affordability stuff? How much of a factor do you think we're going to see in that from Ford?
Yeah, no, I mean, the ability for the economy to respond is almost exclusively based on the labor market. And right now we have a monster shortage on skilled trades. And so while, you know, there's a lot of money on the table from Ottawa, and I'm sure that the provincial government wants to, you know, on their infrastructure, eventually you just run up to this challenge. And I think some of the Ford ministers are even kind of using that as a bit of a expectation lower in terms of even if we had all the money in the world for all of our infrastructure, we don't have the labor to build it. And so mixing, getting the right mix of for the immigration coming in is vital. The other thing, though, quickly I'll mention, David, and I think this is on the minds of a lot of parents in Ontario, and that is the state of our post-secondary education. It's obviously a big part of the training, but also, in our university sector. We have a lot of universities who are in trouble right now with red ink, and I think some relief for our public post-secondary education system in this province. You can't match those skills, and you can't attract the world's best and brightest if you don't have a vibrant post-secondary education system. And right now, our system in Ontario is in need of a lot of attention.
Yeah, Rob, that is an enormous challenge in the province, because they did come up with some extra money, but it's about half of what the Blue Ribbon panel said that they need. And the post-secondary sector now, as you adjusted, the loss of Bill 124, which had wage restraints, which allowed them to deal with some of these challenges. So there's a lot of competing challenges here.
I would add high schools as well are bursting at the seams, and teachers are having a very, very tough time. You know, what's going to be interesting to watch in the budget tomorrow is if this trend of watching conservative governments become and embracing Keynesian economics continues. You saw it with Donald Trump, deep into debt before we had an economic crisis. You're seeing it with other governments, conservative governments around the world, and with all governments, actually. Deficits are creeping up. I'll be interested in watching that number in a government that has pledged some fiscal restraint, whether or not they realize, because people are hurting. I think we heard Ford's minister say over and over again, people are hurting, people are hurting, people are hurting, whether they trade that off for more spending.
That's a really good point, because we saw big deficits in British Columbia, big deficit in Quebec, I think $11 billion.
That's
when you break it down, and who knows where the biggest province in the country is going to go, because we know the federal budget is going to have a deficit of around $40 billion. Okay, gang, we've got to leave it there. Thank you to the Power Panel. Vandana Cotter, Brad Levine, Jamie Ellerton, and Rob Russo. Thanks so much, gang.
Thanks, David.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.